This is Franz. Welcome back to the Sailing in the Mediterranean podcast. It's been a while since I've put a podcast out, but I've been busy. I got an email from one of our listeners. I appreciate it. It's from Jonathan, and he's suggesting that I interview his 80-year-old father who's still sailing and is heading off to Proviza, Greece on May 5th, to go sailing. And I guess he sailed down from England through the French canals and into the Mediterranean years ago and has been sailing around the Ionian Islands for years. So I think that's going to be a great interview when we put it together. I'm trying to set it up so that we can do it via Skype. I like to do my interviews with Skype because I have recording software on my computer. It's a desktop computer that allows me to capture the conversation in both sides. So I can capture his side of the conversation and my side of the conversation, and I can edit either side. So technically, it's just easier to do it via Skype than any other way. So I'm waiting to do that interview. We're trying to set it up. We need to do it probably next week because his father's heading off on the 5th. And interestingly enough, I'm heading off on the 6th. So I'll be heading to Turkey on the 6th of May, and he'll be heading to Greece on the 5th of May. Our paths won't cross because I don't plan on going into the Ionian Seas this year. That's the western side of Greece. And I sailed there last year. And it used to be one of my favorite places to sail until the flotilla and charter fleets basically made every anchorage extremely crowded. I still like it, but it's lost a little bit of its appeal. As sailing becomes more and more popular, anchorages become more and more crowded. So it's a great thing to sail, but too much of a good thing is probably not what I like. I have an interview scheduled, or I did have an interview scheduled, with a woman by the name of Lois Hoffman. We had lost emails. We've somehow failed to connect before, and I was scheduled to interview her last week. And then I looked at my schedule, and I realized I had a conflict with a meeting, and I had to call up and cancel that interview. So we're trying to reschedule that interview. And I'm going to try to schedule an interview that I will actually post while I'm sailing, so I won't go a solid 2 months without a posting to the website. Now, I know I can technically post from anywhere in the world, but I'm hauling a lot of gear to the boat this year, and I just don't want to have to take additional recording gear with me. Even though it's just a little Zoom recorder that I record in, I'm not sure I want to deal with it. I may not. Well, I'll sort of play it by ear. It's not just that, it's also putting out the show notes, and I don't mind talking, but I absolutely dislike testing. That's why I'm never going to be a big Twitterer or a big Facebook person, because typing's not my thing, and texting's not my thing. So this week I'm going to talk about what I've been up to, and it's not going to be about sailing in the Mediterranean. It's actually going to be about sailing in America. Now, I'm just going to deviate this podcast, and I may do it from time to time. For the most part, this podcast is supposed to be about sailing in the Mediterranean, and I was going to talk about the next step of my journey from where I last left off in talking about my travels through the Mediterranean, which was the last episode was, I think, 1999, where I left the boat in Gaeta, Italy. 99, when I left the boat in Gaeta, Italy. So the next podcast where I which will be covering the year of 2000, I'll be taking the boat from Gaeta, Italy, down to Malta. But I don't think I'll get to that this week because I've got too much else to talk about. First of all, I've been sailing. I have a client. His name's Jack. And Jack has been a friend of mine for many years. Again, I met him skiing at Deer Valley 1 year. And has a beautiful boat that he bought years and years ago, keeps it in absolutely immaculate condition, pours a lot of money into it every year. But it's sat in the marina for well over a year and a half since he sailed it the last time. And I think the last time he went sailing was the last time I took him sailing. Well, Jack has Parkinson's disease, and he's had it for about 15 years now. And he used the drugs. I don't know if you're familiar with Parkinson's disease, but it's a terrible disease. They treat it with drugs to mitigate some of the effects of the disease, but the drugs lose their effectiveness over time. And he had pretty much ran out of the ability for the drugs to do him any good, and he was looking at probably dying within a year. About 6 months ago, he went in for brain surgery where they put some sort of a pacemaker in your brain, and you treat the Parkinson's in a surgical way with sensors going out to your different parts of your body, and there's actually a pacemaker sort of thing in your chest, under the skin into your chest. And so that's extended his effectiveness. He's improved quite a bit with that treatment, but he's still unable to sail the boat. And so pretty much he's at the mercy of friends to take him out sailing. I know he knows he trusts me to take him out on his boat, and he trusts another friend of his, Phil, and I won't tell you his last name, but Phil, to take him out on his boat. I think Phil might have taken him out one time since I'm here. Now, Phil lives in New Zealand, and he travels to the States every now and then, and he has a girlfriend in Chile, so he's a real globetrotter. So he doesn't get up here very often. And Jack lives in Camas, Utah, and which is about an hour outside of Salt Lake City. But he also has a house down in Hollywood Hills, which is in Los Angeles. And he also has another house in Ojai, California. He's got plenty of houses. So the winter comes along and Jack leaves Camas, which can get very cold, and he heads down to Los Angeles to stay for the winter. Well, anyway, Jack had been asking me to get together a group of people to take him sailing. So I put it out to one of my other friends and clients, Scott. And I said, Scott, you've been sailing with Jack before. Let's get a group of people together and go down and go sailing with Jack. And so he did. He lined up his brother-in-law and another friend to join us. And Jack called up about 2 days before we were scheduled to go down and said, Franz, the weather's terrible. The weather's forecast to have 40-knot winds. And I don't want to take my boat out in 40-knot winds. And I said, well, Jack, you know, we're coming down anyway. Let's just see what happens. So Scott told his brother-in-law, who was flying out from New Jersey, the situation, and his brother-in-law backed out. So it turned out to be a crew of myself, Jack, Scott, and another individual on the boat, also named Scott. And it turned out this other individual, who's a friend of Scott's, my client Scott, used to be a client of mine at a different job when I first started out in the brokerage field. So we all knew each other. I had to wait until April 12th to drive down to California, actually April 13th to drive down to California, because we celebrated my wife's 60th birthday on the 12th. That was a command performance. I couldn't get out of that. So we had to stay here I had to stay on the 12th. So I had to drive down to California on the 13th. That's probably about a 700-mile drive. So I got up at the crack of dawn in the morning and started heading south on I-15, Interstate 15 from Salt Lake. Drove down to St. George. I had a quick meeting in St. George. It actually ended up lasting longer than I expected. I was looking at a house to buy in St. George, and I put an offer in on a property, so that took a couple hours. And then I drove on down to Ventura, got into Ventura Harbor the night of the 13th, fairly late in the evening. Now, I'm going to do this podcast a little differently. I'm going to be talking a lot about the places I went. And while I'm doing this podcast, I'm going to be looking at photographs that I'm going to be posting that go along with the post of this podcast. Now, the first photograph, if you go actually to the website, medsailor.com, and look at this post, and I'm not sure what the episode is, but I'll title it Santa Cruz Sail. The first photograph is going to be a map of the route I took. And a lot of this podcast is just going to be about the trip I had. It was a fun trip. I was by myself, so I tend to listen to books on tape or podcasts or things to occupy myself. But the trip from Salt Lake down to Ventura, pretty much until Las Vegas, there's not a lot of traffic. There's traffic through Las Vegas, and then there's moderate traffic from Las Vegas on into where I headed was Victorville. And then I sort of skirted around Los Angeles. I didn't want to deal with Los Angeles traffic, so I skirted around Los Angeles by going out towards Palmdale. And then I skirted around that and got into Ventura by basically avoiding the downtown Los Angeles area. Otherwise, you sort of head down I-15 and go around Pasadena, and there's always traffic and traffic jams on the interstates around Los Angeles. So I said, just to avoid that, I took a little longer route, but I think my time was actually better than if I'd gone into Los Angeles. Regardless, it was much more relaxing driving. So the first photo is a photo of the map and the route that I took down and back from Salt Lake down to Ventura. Then I went down the Pacific Coast Highway down to Malibu, and then the 405 down to Newport Beach, where I stayed a night. And the next morning I met a client. Now, this is after the sailing trip I'm talking about. And then I came back up to Victorville. And then instead of coming directly back to Salt Lake, I wanted to do a different route. And that's going to be a whole nother part of the story today. Now, I hope this doesn't bore you, and you're certainly welcome to turn this podcast off and move on to other podcasts. But I enjoyed it, and I thought I'd share it with you. First of all, let's talk about the boat. The boat is a Choi Lee 47-foot boat, sailboat. It's a cutter rig. Even though he doesn't have the staysail rigged very often, he's got it so the staysail stay can be moved over and attached if we want to put up the staysail. It's very comfortable inside. It sleeps 7 or 8 people very comfortably. He's got a compressor refrigerator that runs when the engine runs, but it doesn't run on electricity like most refrigerators now. There's advantages to it in the fact that it's very efficient when the engine is running. But if the engine isn't running, then it loses its heat eventually. It's fairly well insulated, so it does a fairly good job. But again, it's not an electric refrigerator like most modern refrigerators and boats are. So I've got a picture of the harbor, Ventura Harbor, in the post, and it's a huge harbor with I don't know how many hundreds and hundreds of sailboats in the harbor, but it's a big, big harbor, a beautiful harbor, a well-maintained harbor, and relatively expensive, too. Nothing in California is cheap, and particularly the sailing. Jack probably pays in the neighborhood of $500 a month for his slip, and he's at the yacht club, the Ventura Yacht Club. And that's much cheaper than the public harbor. So the Ventura Yacht Club is cheaper to leave your boat at if you're a member than the marina itself is. I noticed there seemed to be quite a few empty slips, which is surprising. It used to be jam-packed. Now, there was one time I went down to this harbor and red tide had rolled in. Now, red tide's an algae. It's a red algae that occasionally comes and hits the west coast of the United States, and I think it hits other parts of the world as well. But if you're ever clamming, you have to check to see what the tide conditions are if there is a bloom of red tide. And if you do, then you cannot eat the clams or the shellfish if there's a blooming of red tide. If you do, you can get what is called paralytic shellfish poisoning, and it can kill you. In fact, in Alaska, one time when they were years gone by, when they were exploring Alaska, there was one bay, and I forget the name of it, where over 100 people of an expedition were killed with paralytic shellfish poisoning. But red tide had hit the west coast of California around Ventura, and what it does is it takes all the oxygen out of the water, and the entire inside of this harbor was filled with dead fish. Fish were just floating belly up, and it took a lot of time to clean out the harbor. But that's what will happen with red tide. Well, this time we didn't have it. It was fine. We got down on the boat. It was a little breezy that night, but not very breezy. We got everything ready, and Jack's in the process of selling his boat. And it's a steal for what he's asking for. If you're in the market for a 47-foot Choi Lee in America, you could do a lot worse than his boat. He's basically going to keep dropping the price until it finally sells, and I think he's asking in the neighborhood of $160,000 for it right now. But it's an immaculate shape, well-maintained. It's U.S. Coast Guard documented. It's not an advertisement for his boat, but if you are looking for a boat in America, it wouldn't be a bad one to go with. A lot of boats are for sale because of the economic conditions, both in America and in Europe right now. So all of his gear was in a storage shed. He had virtually nothing on the boat. So he spent a lot of the day just getting the basics to go sailing with. Fenders, lines, pots and pans to cook in, charts, pretty much everything you need to go sailing. His sheets were on the boat, and his sails were on the boat. So we put up the jib. The jib had been taken off of the roller furling. And so we put up the jib, got the boat ready, and it really took until about 4 in the afternoon to finally get out of the harbor. And this is the afternoon of the 14th, we finally left the harbor. And en route for Santa Cruz Island, which is one of the Channel Islands off of Ventura. Now, the Channel Islands are a national marine preserve. I don't know if it's a marine preserve, but it's part of the national park system. You are not allowed to land on the islands unless you have a permit, which you can get, but we never bother getting them. So we usually just stay on the boat. There's no towns over there to visit. It's just pristine and beautiful. So we headed over to a place called Prisoner's Cove on Santa Cruz Island. We barely got in just as it was getting dark. We dropped our anchor. I think he has a 45-pound CQR on the front, and he had about a 20-pound Fortress that we threw off the back. It's an exposed anchorage. It's open for probably 180 degrees. It's not like the anchorages I'm used to in the Mediterranean where it's pretty protected anchorages. So there's always swells that come in and out of here. What is beautiful about going over to the Channel Islands is the marine life. And most of the times when we sailed across from Ventura over to Santa Cruz Island, you'll see thousands and thousands of dolphins swimming up and down along the currents there. Big fishery there. They catch a lot of squid out there, and there's a lot of marine life for fish to eat and mammals to eat. When we got into the Prisoner's Cove, there was seals jumping around, swimming around, watching us come in, drop our anchor. We were the only one over there. In fact, we were the only boat we saw out there that entire day on the way over. There were no other boats sailing that day, probably because of the weather forecast. We ended up having to motor all the way over. The wind was right on our nose for the most part, so I thought, well, it's typical. We motor over and sail back. So we motored over. We spent the night there. In the morning, the wind had built up, and we were getting about a 2-foot chop into our anchorage. So we were getting bounced around pretty good at the anchorage. Our anchor had held very well, and I'll tell you why in a second. So we got ready, had our breakfast. We pulled up our stern anchor, and as we pulled up our stern anchor, a line came up with it. We'd hooked on some line. I don't know where the line came from, but we just were able to unhook it and let it go and get up our stern anchor. And then the wind kept building on us, and we were bringing up the bow anchor with a windlass. He has a Maxwell windlass. And we were bringing up the bow anchor, and as he brought it up and brought it up, it kept getting slower and slower and slower and harder and harder and harder bringing up. Just as they got to the surface, they could see that they'd grabbed onto a huge chain. This is like a ship chain with 5-inch links and the crossbar between them. He must have brought up almost 1,000 pounds of anchor chain just to get it to the surface, and we couldn't get it up any farther. We were able to bring it up a little farther by tying a line around the chain, our anchor chain, and running it back to a winch, and at the same time cranking on the winch and bring up the windlass little by little. We were able to get it up so we could reach around. Now, this is something you need to understand, and this is a problem you're going to run into if you're a sailor. And I might do a video on this sometime because it's a very easy thing to do if you know how to do it. But to free up a hooked line, and you'll get these hooked lines. Quite often you'll find mooring lines you're hooked onto in the Mediterranean, usually mooring lines for fishermen that have laid moorings out there that are laid on the ground. And this happened to me, in Greece. Well, it's happened to me many times, but when I've tried to explain it to other people, some people have a hard time grasping. I'm going to try to describe how you free up a hooked line or a hooked chain if you catch on something and you need to get free your anchor away from it. First of all, don't grab it with your boat hook and lift it off, because now it's hooked onto your boat hook, and now you're going to be pulled overboard if you're trying to hold onto your boat hook, or you're going to lose your boat hook. I've done that. I've learned my lesson. So there's no point in trying to waste your time hooking it with the boat hook to get it off your anchor, because now you got to get it off your boat hook. And how are you going to do that? Are you strong enough to hold it up, or are you just going to lose your boat hook? So don't waste your time doing that. It's very simple, especially if you have a dinghy. If you have a dinghy, you just jump in the dinghy, roll around, take a line with you, cleat off one end of the line, pass the line under the chain you want to free, or the line you want to free off of your anchor, off of the fluke of your anchor, pass it around, take the free end up, run it over to another cleat, put three or four wraps around the cleat, now lower your anchor down, and now the chain, in this case, this big heavy chain, was now being held by the line we just passed around it. And the anchor was free, so we just dropped the anchor, cleared the anchor, brought the anchor on board, but the boat's still stable because it's being held now by this big chain that we're hooked onto. Now, at this point in time, you can drop the chain just by releasing the free end, the one side of the short side of the rope, and it'll just fall out, and it'll fall back down to the bottom. Just retrieve your line because it's cleated on both sides. Remember, you've just looped it around. You're cleated on one side, cleated on the other side. Then you can pull in. Well, in this case, now that we had the chain ready to be released, we went ahead and got our mainsail up. And the wind was building up fairly heavily right now. So we went ahead and put up the mainsail with three reefs in. And then once we had the mainsail up, then we dropped the chain and we were free. Started the engine, started motoring against it. Just started out the anchorage. And then as we headed out, we decided to head over to the town of Santa Barbara, beautiful town in California, north of Ventura, about 28 miles north of Ventura. And we couldn't quite fetch it. The wind has shifted around to where it was a tight beat. My attitude is, sail comfortably. Don't kill yourself. So we had three reefs in the main, and we had a little bit of the jib out, and we pulled and we started sailing, and we were sailing about 6.5 to 7 knots. The motion was very comfortable. The wind speed was 25 to 27 knots. The waves were building, but it was just a comfortable sail. In his boat, that's nothing. It's a very comfortable sail. Sailed out, passed by the oil derricks that are out there. There's about 7 oil platforms out on the channel between Santa Cruz Island and Santa Barbara, all up and down the coast. A lot of oil comes from California. Most people don't realize that, but there's a lot of oil in California. Sailed up. As we got closer to the coast, the wind died down. We eventually shook out the reefs in the main and pulled the jib out all the way, and we were still going about 6.5 knots. And we got lifted as we got close to the coast. We tacked back around and did a couple tacks, and eventually we were running out of daylight. And then Jack realizes that he doesn't have his documentation papers on board. So I'm thinking, well, most of the time when you go into a marina, they want to see your documentation papers. So I got on the phone and called up the marina and explained the situation to them, that Jack, the owner of the boat, was on the boat, that we should be in their computer because we've been there before, but we don't have any of the papers on board. Can we come in or not? And they said, sure, go ahead and come in. They asked a couple questions to verify that we were who we said we were. We were in their computer, and they said, come on in. And so we had went ahead and headed into Santa Barbara Harbor. As we pulled into Santa Barbara Harbor, there's a picture on the posting of a guy floating around in a dinghy with his wife laying in the front of the dinghy with her legs up, acting as a backrest for him. It's a good picture. It's a funny picture. And he said, well, what was the gale like out there? And I said, what gale? And he said, it's a gale warning today. Nobody's leaving the marina. And I guess it was technically a gale, but it wasn't uncomfortable for the boat we were in. And we didn't really have any problems. Sailing is a very, very simple sport. All you have to do is keep the right amount of sail area up for the wind conditions. That's it. So we went in after a headache of a time dealing with the bureaucracy at the harbor office, because even though they said we could come in, once we got in there, they said, you don't have papers. And Jack was able to call up his boat broker, and they faxed up a copy of his documentation, and that's how we got in. But I was a little bit irritated that they said it was fine to come in, and then they gave us static when we finally did come in. For his boat, the cost of mooring in that marina for one day was $50. They have wonderful facilities, very clean restrooms out on the docks. It's a huge marina. I take some pictures, and they're on the post of the marina. And then the next morning, we spent that night, had a few drinks, spent the night. The next morning, we're all sitting around having coffee, and Jack decides he wants to put some water in the boat. Again, remember I said every boat has problems? We were having problems with one thing or another. The problem we were having was his water pump wasn't pumping water out the kitchen sink. It would come out the bathroom sink, no problem at all. But for some reason, the faucet in the kitchen sink wasn't letting water come through. So there was a little minor problem with the plumbing somewhere. Jack thought he was low on water, so he decided to put some water in the boat. So it's his boat. We're not really paying much attention. He's walking around on the dock borrowing hoses and opening up deck covers for the hose, for the fill. And he put about 5 gallons in, and he realizes he made the classic mistake that every sailor just is worried about every time he puts water in his boat. He put the water into the diesel fuel tank. So we thought about it, and I went down and pulled up the floorboards and looked at the engine and looked at the tanks. And he's got two separate tanks. He's got a rear diesel tank and a forward diesel tank. And I saw that we'd been running off the rear tank, and that was where the water was going directly to. And so I shut that tank off and watched the water fuel separator. We started the engine and watched the water fuel separator, and we were okay. The forward tank had not been contaminated with water, and we had plenty of diesel fuel in that tank as well. So we motored out of the marina. The winds were coming up. There was a big cruise ship off of Santa Barbara. It was one of the cruise ship destinations on the West Coast. And we started sailing south, and Jack wanted to put up the mainsail, but we were going dead downwind, or close to dead downwind. I said, Jack, don't put up the mainsail. It's just going to be in the way. Whenever I'm going downwind, I don't like to have the mainsail up. It just creates the risk of an accidental jibe. Even if you do have it jibed out, even if you do have a preventer on the boom, usually what you end up doing is just blanketing the jib. You're not really gaining much speed as a general rule, and it's much more dangerous, and the boat's harder to control. So if I'm going downwind or a quarter off the seas, dead downwind, so sort of that 90-degree angle towards dead downwind, I will only run with the jib. It's much more comfortable. The boat steers easier. The boat's easier to handle. With the main out, then the boat's always trying to pivot on the main, on the mast, at the point of the mast, where if you're just with the jib out, it's just pulling it downwind. There's much more directional stability that way. So we sailed downwind, and we were going 6.5-7 knots, and we were having the wind indicator was reading 25 to 28 knots. So the wind was blowing from our stern, 30 to 35 knots. Waves were building up through the day, but it wasn't overpowering the boat. Jack kept saying, should we reef? Should we reef? And I said, well, no, you're not overpowering the boat and you're moving just fine. And it's a fairly comfortable motion. We were sort of on the quarter, so we weren't dead downwind where you wallow. It's very uncomfortable to go dead downwind. We're sort of on our quarter. So we sailed on down, and as we got closer and closer to Ventura, you could see the waves breaking on the breakwater, and there were huge waves breaking on the breakwater. And Jack was getting nervous, and I said, well, let's go ahead and reef down the jib a little bit. So we took the jib in about halfway as we approached the breakwater, and we got rolled around pretty good as we rounded up into the protected waters, but no big deal. But I just got a call from Jack, and I haven't talked to him today. It's Sunday, Sunday the 21st of April when I'm doing this podcast. And Jack called me and said everybody in the yacht club thought he was crazy for being out there that day, that nobody else was going out that day. But it wasn't a big deal. It really wasn't a big deal. Comfort out sailing is all dependent on the direction you're going. If we were going the other direction, it would have been miserable out there that day. If we'd been going into the wind, we would have been bounced around like crazy. But because we were going downwind, it really wasn't a problem. So anyway, it's probably going to be the last time I take Jack sailing on that particular boat. He's trying to sell it, and he was really exhausted by the time he got back. I think physically he's just not able to do it anymore. He called me up and thanked me over and over again for taking him out sailing, and it was my pleasure to do that, but I just don't think he's capable of physically sailing anymore on his boat. He may go as a guest on somebody else's boat for day sails, but not longer sails like this. So I have friends down in Newport Beach, and I called him up and I said, do you have a place I can stay tonight? And they said, sure, come on down. So I left, and this was Monday now. And I knew I was going to be dealing with, this is Tuesday, I guess. It was Tuesday when we got back to the marina at 16th. So it was about 4 in the afternoon, and I knew I'd be driving through downtown Los Angeles with the stops and goes of driving the freeways in Los Angeles. So I decided instead of taking that route, I'd just drive the Coast Highway. And as I drove south through the Coast Highway going by Malibu, California, I got some great pictures of some windsurfers out there, some parasurfers and windsurfers out there playing in the waves. And there's some good pictures on the website with that. Pretty area. So I spent the night in the night of the 16th down at my friend's house that live on Balboa Island in Newport Beach. He was actually a college roommate of mine, so we go way, way back. And the next day I had an appointment with one of my clients that lives down in Southern California. And so we met at 10 o'clock, and we were done with our meeting by about noon. And I decided, well, what am I going to do? Do I need to stick around another day? And even though it's delightful to stay down in Balboa, I have a lot of things I need to do to take care of before I go sailing. So I decided I'd head back, but I'd come back a different route. I'd come back and forth between Salt Lake City and Los Angeles and Newport Beach and Ventura, well, probably 50, 60 times in my life. And I've always taken Interstate 15 down, the most direct route down, which goes down through Las Vegas. But I decided I wanted to come back a different way. So I came back by way of Newport Beach to Victorville, California. And then at Victorville, California, I chose to go towards Bishop, California. And this is going to be on the east side of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. And I've taken a lot of photographs. I've taken, 50 or 60 photographs that are going to be posted on this posting of the trip back. And so I started driving north, and there's some beautiful, beautiful shots of first of all, the desert you go through before you get to the Sierra Nevada Mountains. And I stopped at a little place called Randsburg, California, which is an an old Western town, sort of a, almost looks like a movie set. It was a mining town at one point in time. I guess they mined, it was gold that brought people there. In reality, the Western United States was settled by cattle ranchers and miners. not really farmers. The farmers settled the Midwest of the United States, but the western part of the United States was miners, people prospecting for gold and silver, and ranchers, cattle ranchers. So I stopped and wandered around Randsburg, California for a while, and then I continued on up, and then I followed the eastern side of the Sierra Nevada Mountains on up past Death Valley. Death Valley would have been on my right. And then I got on Highway 6, U.S. Highway 6. And U.S. Highway 6 is famous because it's the loneliest highway in America. And I tried to get some pictures that sort of show what lack of traffic there is and the wide open spaces in it. And so I drove on Highway 6 that night up to the town of Tonopah, Nevada. And I thought Tonopah, Nevada was sort of a dying little town in Nevada, but I pulled in and I couldn't find a hotel room. I think I got the last hotel room in town because there's a big boom in mining coming back to Tonopah. And also they've got the Tonopah Test Range, or the Nellis Weapons Testing Range, which is the area between Tonopah, Nevada and Las Vegas, Nevada, that big test range where they tested a lot of the experimental aircraft. Area 51 is in that area. So a lot of government spending, a lot of private industry spending in Tonopah, a lot of pickup trucks, a lot of GMC and Ford pickup trucks in the parking lots of the hotels and motels there. Took a lot of pictures of Tonopah. The name of the high school is the Tonopah Muckers. And if you know anything about mining, you know it's about mucking out the mine. So I got some pictures of some old mine shafts. I like the romance of the old mining towns in Nevada. Just, it gives me a feeling of the old West and the way it used to be. And Tonopah was actually, the silver was discovered by a rancher that came there to do some prospecting. And he found silver there and sort of created the first silver boom in America in Tonopah, Nevada. Got some pictures of some sculptures there, some of the old beat up mining shacks there, some of the mines there. And then I continued on Highway 6. And from Tonopah, the next gas station is 163 miles away. And I've got a picture on the website that shows this road just going off as far as you can see in the distance. And I think there's one vehicle coming towards me on that picture. And if you look at Nevada, Nevada is called Basin and Range. In fact, Nevada is the most mountainous state in the United States. Most people think of Colorado or Utah or California as having mountains. But if you actually look at Nevada on a relief map, Nevada is just mountain, they call it basin and range country. So basins and then mountains and basins and mountains and basins and mountains and basins and mountains. And so from Tonopah, I started heading sort of north. East-northeast on U.S. Highway 6. And the next stop is 163 miles, which is going to be Ely, Nevada. But going across the mountain, going across on U.S. Highway 6, we go past the Tonopah Test Range, which is part of the Sandia National Laboratories. And I took a lot of photographs, so you can get a feel for the wide-open spaces and the lack of traffic on this road. It's open-range country, which means there's cattle that will wander across the road at night, so you have to be careful if you're driving at night because there's nothing to keep the cattle from wandering on the road. I saw wild horses on this road. So I went off to one summit, which is called McKinley Tank Summit, which is elevation of 6,391 feet. And there were seven different summits that I went over between Tonopah and Ely. And I took pictures of every one of the summits, and they're all on the website. Also, I saw wild antelope while I was driving across this road. I saw a cattle roundup. I've got pictures of that. I've got pictures of the antelope. I saw deer. And it just really gave me a feel for the Old West. If you ever decide to visit the United States, if you're already in the United States and you want to get a real feel for the Old West, I highly recommend driving across Highway 6 from Ely, Nevada to Tonopah, or from Tonopah to Ely, Nevada. And if you're really spending some time in the West, go ahead and go into California, go down to Bishop, and head out into the Death Valley that'd be a good circle, you know, starting in Salt Lake, going out to Wendover, south on Highway 6 from Wendover to Ely. You might do a side trip to the Great Basin National Park, where the oldest living trees, the bristlecone pine trees, are living. Continue over to Tonopah, to Bishop, to Death Valley. Then you can circle around to Las Vegas, spend some time in Las Vegas. And if you want to, then you can head on down to Los Angeles or circle around up through Utah, visit the wonderful national parks in Utah, which include Zions Park, which is not too far away from Las Vegas, and then Bryce National Park. You can see Arches National Park. You might do a side trip to see the Grand Canyon. But I love living in the western United States. I'm a westerner. I lived 4 years in South Bend, Indiana, and I could not get out of the Midwest fast enough. I was going to talk about some other things today, but this podcast has gone on too long. I hope I haven't bored you, but I thought I'd share with you what I've been doing the last couple of weeks. I think the next podcast will be an interview with one of my listeners. If you have suggestions for listeners that I could interview, or you have some information you'd like to share with our listeners, feel free to contact me, Franz, F-R-A-N-Z, at medsailor.com. I appreciate you listening. About half of our listeners are from the UK. Then the next, actually the largest number of listeners are from the UK or the US. Then the UK is very close to the US in listeners. And then all the other countries. And there's a lot of other countries represented. We have people in Turkey, Malta, the Scandinavian countries, almost all the Scandinavian countries. Every Scandinavian I've met speaks English as well as I do. I appreciate you listening. If you get a chance, please look at the photographs on this post, because there's some great ones. It's too bad I can't really load up the high-resolution photographs, because I have to sort of limit the size of my photographs to fit in the post. But the high-resolution photographs, you can almost see the hair on the deer, the fur on the deer. But on the website, that just gives you a sort of a feel of what you're looking at. Anyway, I appreciate you listening. Thanks a lot.